Hello, my name is Brian McKenna. I'm one of the editors at Computer Weekly, and I'm here to bid you a very warm welcome indeed to the Computer Weekly
Downtime Upload
podcast.
And for the benefit of the tape, those two other voices were...
I'm Caroline Donnelly, I'm a senior editor at Computer Weekly.
And I'm Brian Glick, I'm the editor-in-chief.
And sadly missing this week is Claire, who is enjoying herself on holidays, so it's not that sad, but she'll be back. She'll be back next week. Now Claire is not a fan of Line of Duty, so it's a great opportunity for us who are to have a bit of a chat about the technology side. I'm going to try and stick to the technology side, although we'll probably fail of Line of Duty, and it's a good time to discuss it because of course the great finale is this Sunday, feature length episode. And the rest of the podcast, just to take you through what we're going to discuss today, Brian's going to, our editor-in-chief is going to talk about the Huawei controversy, which is the gift that keeps giving, and this week seemingly has claimed the career of Gavin Williamson. Caroline, you've just come back from...
the Open Infrastructure Summit, previously known as the OpenStack Summit. So yeah, after a couple of days there, finding out about all things open source and cloud.
In Denver, Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And this week in London, I caught up with the co-creator of Hadoop, Doug Cutting, on the eve of Strata. But first, let's talk about Line of Duty. I'm just going to start off with a couple of observations about the two broad protagonists, the OCG, Organized Crime Ganger Group. The Organized Crime Group. And also the police themselves. Now, the OCG, how do they make their money? What is their business model?
Stealing things and selling them.
Yeah. wasn't it fake passports? There's lots of like printing
presses.
Exactly.
Yeah. They do seem very old school. So John Corbett, as a person, but also as a member of the OCG, has a printing background. He was a printer, and that's how he gets the job as a forger with the OCG. So he's a print guy who's been driven by digital transformation into a life of crime.
That's
wonderfully tenuous, Brian.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. I've been working on that for a while. And also, they don't really seem to be into cybercrime. I mean, have they not been reading Computer Weekly?
I know, they could make a lot more money maybe through ransomware and things. They're obviously not particularly scrupulous about holding people hostage and in physical form, so why not just cut out the middleman and just do it over
They're good old-fashioned analog crooks, aren't they?
They like to
steal things that they can feel and touch and sell to other crooks.
Drugs
mostly, yes.
Guns.
Drugs, guns.
They've been doing a lot of kind of intercepting lorries is a big part of their MO in this particular season.
But we have had for the first time a cyber character, not as in a character only exists in cyber, we do have the cyber security officer as a character for the first time.
Yes, whose name we were struggling to remember, which perhaps says something about the place of IT.
They pretty much disregard her input. So they're trying to... infiltrate the OCG, and they're using this piece of software which looks a bit like I don't even know if it's real software. I doubt it is. It looks like instant messaging, and so it's probably Skype.
Yeah, it would be Skype, but they can't call it Skype because
it's called CryptoChat.
So they're using CryptoChat, and she's giving them all if you want to fool the OCG that you're the person who they think they're communicating with, I've made up some pre-prepared responses, and they're just like, nah, I'm just gonna
flow charts that they seem to think will determine exactly what they should say.
Which probably should be replaced now by AI anyway. So she's on borrowed time, so we don't need to know her name.
Yeah. But she talks about metadata a lot. Metadata is clearly their big thing in this. If you talk to the police at the moment about what's their big digital challenge, which is something that isn't reflected in Line of Duty at all, it's just the vast volume of digital evidence that the police have to work with now.
Yeah.
You know, they can pull so much information off mobile phones, from communication networks and that sort of thing. There was a story I saw in The Guardian this week about the Forensic Services Union, I think it was, complaining that they don't have enough resources to deal with the volumes of digital evidence that are coming in now. And there have been stories over the last year of cases that have been that have collapsed because of digital evidence that hasn't been retrieved and hasn't been disclosed and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's quite entertaining to see all the talk about metadata, and you know, instantly they've found in line of duty, they managed to analyse all this data. The reality is they've probably got gigabytes of data there that would take them weeks to work their way through. But of course that doesn't quite make such a dramatic Sunday night TV show, does it?
Yeah, because they always seem vaguely surprised when it's Tatlin, isn't it? She walks in, she's, oh, I've just found out, I've pulled this data. And they're, oh, wow, really? Oh, wow, thanks for that. Like, you're sitting on a treasure trove of things. It shouldn't be that surprising. It should be accepted now. But there was talk the other day, there was metadata, and then them scrambling IP addresses using dongles. I was like, wow, they really are old school, aren't they?
They like the word dongle as well, don't
they?
Yeah,
I was sitting there thinking, can you do that?
The OCG say so. And that's the other thing, actually, if you draw parallels with the technology industry on this, is how many acronyms do they love an acronym.
Indeed, they love an acronym,
yeah,
don't they?
That first episode, you had OCG, Undercover Officer, that was UCO, yeah. And then whatever the raid was codenamed something else. And I was just like, it's like being at work, trying to keep track of like what
and
for the hell
TLAs, you know.
For
the benefit of the DIR.
But
they're useful. They are so useful as terms.
Technology is a wonderful little thing, and they've used this in line of duty. A wonderful way of explaining away apparently otherwise slightly convoluted plot twists, like in one of the most recent episodes, Hastings, who may or may not be H, was uncovered by his team when he was going somewhere he thought was really secret, and there was like a moment where he thought, how did you know he was there? And then somebody came out with a line about, oh yeah, we traced the call that somebody made to somebody else and cross-matched it with a telephone number for something and found you here.
And it's
It's like, vroom, technology, metadata. Oh, okay, I get it now, right? I've got that plot twist now. Okay.
Yeah. That was
quite a popular thing for most screenwriters, it seems these days.
You'll
either have the tech guy or you'll have the hacker who will hit a few keys and suddenly find out, ah, I've got the answer.
But what do we think of Ted on the computer? Because he seems to be very happy doing that.
Jumping in, doesn't he?
He's in control of the keyboard.
Well, as we may or may not find out in the final episode, is to use the keyboard to deliberately misspell definitely. This is the big clue.
But he is a man of a certain age, so you would expect him to be a senior guy, so you would expect him to be uncomfortable with tech.
Yeah, possibly.
I've never seen him use a computer before.
He never does anything in his office apart from stand up and glare at the rest of the team. Like, what are you up to? And just
some people fell up.
Yeah, and Mother of God, like, responding to stuff all the time.
That Mother of God came from his experience of using technology. That's where he developed that. Like most of us have. Every time we get to Microsoft Blue Screen, it's Mother of God, not again.
Yeah.
I think that may have come from his culture, but
never.
Actually, another bit of technology we haven't talked about is their love of burner phones.
Yes.
So these go
OCG, not the police.
Yeah. Which is a pay-as-you-go SIM, unregistered handset, and
you can buy them.
Yeah, you can just buy them on the high street. Yeah, I was trying to find out if there is I was trying to do some digging and research into what the sales of these phones are. And sadly, there's not a lot of conclusive evidence, because I was hoping there might be somewhere in some kind of Gartner report or Forrester thing that organised crime are big. Users of these big buyers, but is that a user group we should be trying to get in with, just to find out what their technology buying decisions are and things like that?
Be careful, we don't want the Met Police to carting you off.
Well, I don't know, there might be some members of the team who quite like that. So so there's that. But I was thinking as well, it's quite a wasteful use of technology. Like, if burner phones are used in lots of programs for nefarious deeds to be carried out, so like Breaking Bad, whenever they had a burner phone, they would snap it in half and throw it over their shoulder and forget it ever existed. But obviously that's not very sustainable. So I was looking into it, and you can get apps now that will act as a burner phone, but you can use your regular handset. So from a privacy point of view, they're amazing. So if you're on dating sites and stuff like that and you don't want someone to know your real number, you could communicate with them via this app. And I was just like, well, that's really good. It's a lot fewer mobile phones going into landfill.
mobile phone industry is slowly moving towards the idea of software SIMs anyway.
Mm.
So instead of getting a physical SIM, you'll have a software SIM. And so if you've got software SIMs, at some point or other, that's going to open it up much more for people to have short-term telephone numbers based on a software SIM that changes as often as you need it to.
Mm.
I'd love to hear, on the off chance that we have any members of police IT departments listening to this, to get in touch with us and tell us what the reality is of using technology and the reality of the technology used in line of duty. Most people I've ever talked to in and around police IT generally acknowledge that police IT is old and inefficient and full of legacy and really struggling to keep up with the demands of the digital age. So I'd love to know whether there's any police IT people sitting there watching Line of Duty, shouting at the screen every time they do anything with IT and saying, there's no way they could do that.
I think the thing that it looks like they spend most of their budget on is they're putting those skins on over all their software, like those overlays that say AC12 at the top. So when this other anti-corruption unit turned up, AC3, they've got their own ones as well. It's like, how much money do they spend on that?
Yeah.
So that's where the police budget's going with regard to wherever Line of Duty operates.
And Patricia Carmichael, is she going to be the nemesis of Ted?
Could she be H? That's the thing.
Yeah,
she seems very intent on sending him down. She's a very cool customer, so.
Well, by the time the podcast goes out, we will know.
Mm.
Perhaps. So only two more sleeps to the next dramatic finale of Line of Duty. Turning to our very own Ted Hastings.
Oh God, thank you.
He's not a bank cop.
Only in the sense of being the gaffer.
Oh, okay.
I hasten to add, because Brian is much, much, much younger than Ted.
Those of you who can't see what's happening on this podcast, I'll accept that comment, Brian. Thank you.
So your leader in the e-zine this week, Brian, is all about Wally.
Yeah, for any tech journalist, I think, at the moment, there's an entertainment factor in finding the fact that suddenly Huawei has become the most talked about technology company in the world at the moment. We've been writing about Huawei 15 years at least, and up until the last 6 months or so, the most interesting thing about them has been people making gags about the name.
Which continues.
And trying to remember how to spell it. For most of this time, they've been a vaguely interesting up-and-coming Chinese networking equipment supplier, with a little bit of the air of that, oh, they're Chinese, are they a bit dodgy about them? You would think to read national newspaper coverage, this is something that's just come up very recently, but Huawei first really came big in the UK in 2005. They've been involved in the UK's telecommunication network as a major supplier to BT for nearly 15 years.
And they displaced Marconi.
They displaced Marconi. Yeah, yeah. BT was doing a big project called 21CN, 21st Century Network, which was basically transforming BT's network backbone from old analog technologies to newer digital technologies, in the big bid for that, Huawei won it, and Marconi didn't, and that effectively put Marconi bust. There was a little bit of political ruckus about the time. There was a lot of this, you should be buying British, not Chinese type of thing. But Huawei has been being happily used within British telecoms networks for more than 10 years. The government has always been aware of the potential risk of Chinese government involvement. In 2010, basically told Huawei to set up this, what's called the Huawei Cybersecurity Evaluation Centre.
Yeah,
In Banbury, mm-hmm. Yes. Which basically is a carefully controlled environment in which Huawei has to open up all its products, its source code, its engineering, the technical capabilities of its staff, to probably the most intense scrutiny that any technology supplier has to face.
And those staff are cleared, aren't they?
They're all security cleared.
MI5, MI6, yep. GCHQ. Yep. Yep.
And the work of this centre is overseen by GCHQ. There has an oversight board that's chaired by a chap called Kieran Martin, who is GCHQ's lead on cybersecurity, yeah, and who runs the National Cyber Security Centre. They publish their reports, they report back to the government's National Security Advisor, and this is why GCHQ is saying we're okay with Huawei being in the UK's 5G networks, so long as it's only in the edge areas and not in the core areas. What this is really showing is this growing intersection between technology and politics. If you're looking at Huawei from a purely technological perspective, the products seem to be pretty good, they're cost effective, GCHQ are happy with their security capability. The issue is whether it's considered politically acceptable for Chinese products to be used in this way, especially with all the criticisms that the US is having about them. The great irony of all this sort of thing, of course, is that the reason the US is saying this is because China has laws that says Huawei and any other technology company, when ordered to by the Chinese government, have to open up their products and give them back doors and this sort of thing, which of course is such a terrible law to have that the US has an identical one that allows the US government to do the same thing. And as we found out from the Edward Snowden revelations, US government is quite happy to take advantage of being able to exploit these backdoors in products. So just imagine the furore there would be if the Chinese government suddenly turned around and said, for example, we're not going to allow Cisco products to be used anywhere in China anymore because they're an American company and America has these laws that allows a back door. This is very much a political debate, not a technological debate that has suddenly arisen. But Brian, you were 2 weeks ago, was it? 2 weeks you were there at Huawei.
I can neither confirm nor deny.
You were there. You were behind the scenes at Huawei. So what was your take?
We discussed this quite a bit last week. I mean, they do seem terribly nice. The John Lewis partnership of China, in some ways, because of their ownership structure and because of the regard with which they are held by Chinese middle class people who are burgeoning in numbers and coming over to the UK to spend money on Burberry and stuff. So they love Huawei and their mobile phones are very nice to look at. But I did speak to an American executive, actually, Doug Cutting, who I'm going to talk about in a bit. And he said, well, okay, but at the end of the day, China is an adversary. I mean, from an American point of view, Huawei has been kept out of the American market. Mm. I don't think you can even buy a Huawei mobile phone in America. Sense. I might be wrong about that.
Yeah, same with another Chinese company called ZTE, which is another big Chinese telecoms firm and mobile phone firm, which the UK government, the US government and the UK government has banned. The UK government won't allow any ZTE equipment in the UK.
Sure.
But they do allow Huawei.
So the argument would be that in China, to do business in China, the Chinese government gets to see what it wants.
Hmm.
Whereas at least in America, there is resistance to that. And they do have elections and so on. So it is as you say, it's not a technological matter, really. It's a geopolitical matter in terms of the big, great power conflict between the United States and China.
Although Carol and I were talking this morning about the event that you're going to be talking about, the OpenStack, and you mentioned that Huawei were one of the sponsors.
Yeah.
So a big event in Denver in the heart of the US, and there's Huawei still there as a sponsor of this event.
It was really interesting, actually. Something that came back from feedback from some of the other journalists who were on the trip were just saying that at the moment when you speak to Huawei, there's maybe a bit of anti-American sentiment in some of their messaging because of all the challenges that they're facing at the moment, as we've talked about. But when you're in America and you're talking to Huawei at events like that, there's absolutely nothing of the sort. So, which I thought was really quite entertaining, actually.
Yeah, and there is a big, what's that word in biology, symbiosis between America and China anyway. You know, this trade war can't continue forever. This current administration won't continue forever. Although I think Huawei has been regarded with suspicion in the US even before the Trump administration.
Yeah, but it suits his agenda with the whole, you know, buy America and make America great again. It's, you know, it feeds into a lot of his sort of rhetoric around all of that as well. You know, it's not hard to see where his motivations are coming from on this.
The truth of the matter in terms of the American economy is like our stuff, China is the workshop of the world. I mean, if you turn over a... go out and grab an HP printer and turn it upside down, it'll say made in China.
Made in China is one of the best known brands in the world. one of the most reliable brands in the world, you know. Every iPhone you buy has been made in China. Nobody has seems to have a complaint about that, you know.
Yeah, and there is that line about dying for an iPhone.
Oh, with regard to
the Foxconn.
Foxconn.
Foxconn, yeah.
Mm.
But of course, the big story this week, Brian, was the sacking of unceremonious sacking of Gavin Williamson.
Of course, yes. The fascinating thing about this is you know, I talked about the intersection of technology and politics earlier, but you know, technology has really started to become a major political issue now. And obviously, Williamson was Gormley's Gavin was sacked for allegedly leaking from a National Security Council meeting. You know, what he leaked about was technology related, and that's considered such sensitive information now. You know, we're going to see so much more of this. We're going to see so much more of technology having an impact on day-to-day politics. You know, everybody picks out at the moment Matt Hancock, who's health secretary at the moment, and is, you know, generally seen as the government digital geek, the one guy who has some understanding at least of the technology world in government. I would say, you know, within the next generation, you know, if you're not a largely technologically literate individual, you're not going to be able to make it to the top of politics. And you know, I think one day things like, you know, what's happened with Gavin Williamson, we're going to look back on those and sort of say, yeah, that was when it started to happen.
Mm. My big question is, what's happened to Kronos, the tarantula?
Oh God! Yes, Gavin Williamson's tarantula. Yes.
Has he been squished?
Perhaps he was a Chinese plant all along.
Yeah, might have been bugged.
Yeah. Well, I mean,
very good.
Indeed, excellent.
See, that's why I'm here.
Well, we have discussed in this podcast bringing in dogs to work, but I think bringing in a tarantula.
Yeah, might be a little
not
bit.
Not such a fan of that.
Yeah, spider phobia is real.
Okay, from China to the great open, freedom-loving plains of open source in America, Caroline.
Yes, I was in Denver, Colorado this week for the Open Infrastructure Summit, which is the new name for the biannual OpenStack Summit. Now, before I get into that, Denver is kind of renowned for being a bit of a cursed place. So for the benefit of the tape, wannabe DCI Donnelly is going to show the two Bryans a picture, and I want to see what you make of this. So it's not in colour, but usually that is blue, and it's got red glowing eyes, and it greets you as you come out of Denver International Airport. And it's called Blucifer by the locals. And it's thought to be cursed because it was installed in 2008, but 2 years before that, the sculptor who was working on it, a large chunk of that fell off and it killed him. So now people, so like I say, you exit the airport, you see this huge thing bearing down you with its big red glowing eyes, and the locals, well, it's quite mixed. Some locals have set up petitions, they want it removed, they just think it's a bad omen to have at the opening of your airport. And other people just, oh, we love it, and you know, it really, you know, makes us stand out. So
is this a sign of the West?
It's a bucking, yeah, bucking bronco, is it, basically?
Yeah, yeah, so it's a big horse. But yeah, it's supposed to embody the Wild West.
It would not
West.
Look out of place in Game of Thrones.
No, not at all.
Certainly, well, the picture we've got over there with its Night Walker-ish eye there. You know.
Yeah, so that was a big discussion point at the show. It's an interesting event, the Open Infrastructure Summit, as is called now. You know, they happen every 6 months. So some of these events you'll get, you know, there'll be more news than others, and other ones it feels more like an update of what they've already been talking about. And I think this one is very much in that category. So they were sharing, I guess, lots of progress reports on how this initiative they've embarked on to move from being all about their open source cloud enabling platform OpenStack. They want to move beyond that because enterprises are doing more with cloud now than just wanting to set up private or public clouds. OpenStack have expanded to other projects that you can sort of fit on top of OpenStack and expand its functionality and things like that. So there's lots of progress reports on that, which is all quite interesting. But something that did come out of the show, which is part of this strategy of theirs, is that they've been talking about it for several years now, is that they want to form closer alliances with adjacent open source communities. And on the face of it, that will kind of make sense. Their argument is that there's so many integration challenges trying to mix, say, technologies with OpenStack from technologies made by other communities. It actually slows down kind of enterprises that are looking to digitally transform, which I know is a term lots of people hate, but it's handy shorthand, I'm convinced. Their argument is they want to help overcome these integration challenges and just make life easier for users, which is all very admirable. But there was a few kind of comments made in the various sessions at the show that maybe their attempts to form these alliances with these adjacent communities aren't always being as welcomed by other foundations as you would think, even despite the fact, you know, there's, I think we talked about on the podcast last week, you know, their argument is that
Yeah.
If everyone's kind of collaborating on projects, that can save a lot of duplication of effort. If you think of, you've got all these different foundations working in isolation, there's a risk that they might be all working on similar projects and technologies, and maybe only a few of those will take off. So why not just focus your efforts on making one of these technologies really good by everybody joining in? So I interviewed the chairman of the board of the OpenStack Foundation, who's also quite high up at SUSE, a guy called Alan Clark, and I sort of picked his brains on this. It's like, you know, so what, you know, and he's such a really nice guy. Shorty, he's like got the most calming voice ever. He's just a very mild-mannered guy. I asked him about it, and he said, you know, they've had a very positive response on the whole about wanting to forge ties with other communities, but there can be some mixed responses. And he just said, oh, it's down to personalities, and he wouldn't expand on it anymore. But so there was no naming of names, like who's not being particularly friendly, who's not getting on board with any of this. But it just felt quite interesting, because the whole tone of like the open infrastructure summits and things like that is very kind of, it's a bit of a love-in, everyone is all very diplomatic, you know, there's no real kind of animosity anywhere. So the fact that this was being just as emerging as like a story thread, if you like, was just, it was quite interesting.
I mean, there's an interesting, almost philosophical debate in this, in that obviously, you know, open source has got to where it has now through collaboration and community, as you say, there's a little bit about that. Now that it's becoming a much more dominant part of enterprise IT, now most of the cloud is built on open source, you know, are we going to start to see different factions of the open source community becoming much, much more competitive with each other in the way that non-open source vendors have always been. It's quite a difference in mindset from moving to being the geeky community collaborative disruptor to suddenly becoming the people who are providing most of the software that the web and the cloud runs on, which is obviously, you know, no matter how much the open source software itself might be free, it's still pretty lucrative.
Because Mark Shuttleworth, who's the founder of Canonical, he had quite a brief section in the keynote of the show, and he sort of made the point, like, the last thing that anyone wants to do is replace sort of warring vendors, proprietary vendors, with warring foundations. Mark Collier, who is the chief operating officer of OpenStack, he sort of made the point that, you know, if the foundations can't play nicely together, at the end of the day, the developers who are working on these projects probably don't work on projects in isolation. They might work on OpenStack, they might work on something, say the Linux Foundation are working on. So you would just go further down the chain. You would maybe look to engage sort of with the user community directly rather than, you know, sit down and have like great dinners with, you know, the senior leaders at these other places. Because at the end of the day, you need to put, say, competitive differences aside and do what's best for your user groups, really.
And so this week I caught up with the father or the co-creator of one of the most famous open source projects, Apache Hadoop. So I caught up with Doug Cutting. The whole question of the place of open source now came up in that conversation. We got to, because I was asking about the two tribes of enterprise software, which is quite stodgy on the one hand, Oracle, SAP, the kind of suppliers that our CIO readers have been dealing with for years and years. And then the culture of the hoodies, basically, in the internet companies, the likes of Google, Yahoo, where he worked. And he said a few things about that, which basically, in the end, came down to saying that his tribe, the internet software development tribe, was on the right side of history. And the bulk of the new things that we'll be developing, especially around data, whether it's AI, machine learning, the bulk of that's going to be done in the sort of family of technologies that his company, Cloudera, which is now merged with Hortonworks, its main rival, to produce what he describes as the biggest standalone open source software company after Red Hat, once Red Hat is properly acquired by IBM. But in the course of the conversation, I mentioned to him this whole controversy around, specifically it was MongoDB, a company based on the open source MongoDB database, their tech being incorporated by Amazon Web Services into a cloud service, and how there was a lot of talk across the press, the IT press, about how unfair and unjust this was, AWS coming along and eating the lunch of an open source software supplier, and I expected him to express maybe some sympathy for MongoDB, but not at all. He was very scathing. He was saying people who think like that, a kind of the more kind of religious open source advocates, are howling at the moon. He described them as the lunatics, and this is a very mild-mannered, softly spoken individual, Doug Cutting. He said, "Look, every day I've worked on open source, I've had a paycheck for that. It's not about sharing. Open source projects at their very best are where you have very self-interested contributions, and that's what makes the software better, because people want to use a more standardized version rather than having to do, you know, maintain it themselves. But they do that for their own commercial self-interest." I thought that was interesting to hear that sort of perspective.
The point you made there around with MongoDB, that did come up at OpenStack with Mark Collier, who I mentioned previously, and his take on the whole thing was kind of similar. He sort of made the point that what AWS is doing is legally fine, it's within the terms of the licensing, and he's like, so I was of the same view. You'd think kind of open source guys sticking together and all that, but
you can't say open source is free for all to use so long as we like you.
So long as
you're not a big multinational behemoth who can develop this themselves. You know, open source is free to use if you're nice and if you're small and you're little and friendly with us. You know, I think it's you know, alluding back to what we were saying about cultural change in potential cultural change in the open source community as they become a more and more dominant force. I think, you know, the MongoDB situation is quite a good example of quite a lot of these sort of potential conflicts that we'll see coming up more and more as they get used more and more by the new giants of the technology.
As we talked about, open source is becoming such a battleground for the public cloud companies. Like, every single one has made some kind of commitment of various forms about how much they love open source and things like that. And on the AWS side, with the MongoDB situation, when I was at Google Cloud Next a couple of weeks ago, they made a big song and dance in the keynote about the fact that Google Cloud Platform is like the home for these seven different database companies, including MongoDB. So it was like the seven samurai all came up on stage. That's like Confluent, DataStax, Elastic, MongoDB, and Redis 7, and a couple of others. They all came on stage and said, "Oh, we're gonna make our services available as a managed service through GCP." And then there was a Q&A afterwards where they sort of talked about sort of some of the other problems they've run into on other public cloud platforms. AWS wasn't explicitly mentioned because I don't think anyone want to cut their nose off to spite their face. There was talk about how in the AWS marketplace, where you can acquire sort of, I guess, SaaS versions of all their technologies, it's actually quite hard to get hard for their products to be discoverable. So this is why this announcement by Google that they're going to be working so closely with these seven was seen as so significant, because it's like, look, we're putting you front and centre of our big cloud event in the prime location in the keynote and things like that, as a kind of badge of honour. You have a home here. Google Cloud is a happy place for open source database companies to reside.
Basically. I mean, that's very interesting to hear, having been talking to Doug Cutting this week. When I mentioned the two tribes thing, he said, okay, fair enough, there are two tribes and so on. But he said, you know, we're not going to displace Oracle or SAP from what they do, because they do what they do and we do what we do.
Yeah.
But more that they will be competing with AWS or Google or Microsoft. It's the cloud providers who will be providing some of that kind of Hadoop-centric functionality out to CIOs. That's going to be that's more of an issue, which is how we got onto the whole MongoDB versus AWS thing in the first place. And then while he was talking about that, he then said that the great advantage, in his view, of Cloudera is that they're not wedded to one particular technology. So they're not sentimental about Hadoop at all. Whereas he said, and he mentioned almost all of the companies that you've just mentioned, and said it's hard to imagine any of those without their specific tech.
Oh, okay.
So that's you would think he would be quite sentimental about Hadoop, because Hadoop originally, the original Hadoop was his son's toy elephant. And I asked, what's happened to Hadoop? He's in a sock drawer.
Oh.
he's not in a safe somewhere with lots of insurance wrapped around him and so on. So there, I mean, he's quite happy to move on from Hadoop as such. Whereas he was saying these other vendors, the ones you've just mentioned, are very wedded to their tech. So it's very interestingly disruptive the way the cloud vendors have come in, the cloud providers have come in and reshaped all sorts of IT markets. But Brian, you're probably closer than any of us to the crusty old CIO community, these hard bitten.
Don't you dare call them crusty to their face.
What do they think of this? Do they care about the fate of small open source venture capital companies, or do they just want the best tech for their business?
At the CIO level, they're not bothered that one way or the other.
There's no sentiment.
They're much warmer towards open source now than they were 10 years ago, say. You know, 10 years ago, open source meant Linux, basically.
Yeah.
It was just, oh, should we use Linux or should we use Unix? Should we use Linux or should we use Windows? And, you know, I think the main thing for CIOs now is they're much more open to open source. But at the end of the day, the criteria they're going to use for it are going to be exactly the same. Does it do what we need it to do? Is it cost effective for us? Because obviously they still have to put a lot of cost into it in terms of support and maintenance that goes around it. So, it might be cheaper to get a copy of MongoDB than it is to get a copy of SQL Server, for example. But that doesn't necessarily make it in the long term the cheapest option if they have to spend a huge amount on buying MongoDB skills rather than more widely available SQL Server skills, for example. I think CIOs will be quite happy to step back from, you know, the internal culture wars of the open source community. The major observation you'd make is that they're much more open and much warmer towards the use of open source now than they have been.
But it's the technology, they don't care about the fate of individual open source. Yes.
Only within the context of whether they use that software themselves. So, you know, if somebody's made a big investment in OpenStack, for example, you know, they're going to be pretty concerned if, in the unlikely event, OpenStack is struggling financially and not liable to make it. You know, so you know they have an interest from that perspective. But that's exactly the same as if they're using Oracle and suddenly Oracle went bust, which is pretty unlikely, I should add, for legal reasons. They have that same sort of...
And long-term decline, according to Doug Cutting.
As somebody once said, he would say that, wouldn't he?
Yeah. Mandy Rice Davis. Yeah. Okay, only two more sleeps to the final episode of Line of Duty this season. I think there'll be another season that the BBC's commissioned.
Mm-hmm.
By the time this is podcasted out to the public, we will know more.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps we won't know who H is.
Well, I don't know.
Will we know?
I don't know.
We have no idea. Yeah. We have no idea. Maybe we won't. I still have the theory that H is not a person. There you go. Put myself, my neck on the line, recording this before the show to people who will listen to it afterwards. I still think H is not a person. I thought there was a little clue in a previous episode where the OCG went into a room within which was a freezer containing the dismembered remains of a character from the first series, and the camera lingered on the fact that the room was number B, and I just wondered whether that meant H is actually a place rather than a person, or where H would commute, where the person would communicate from. But who knows?
Being on a trip, I was really worried that because I was away in the US when that episode was on and the latest Game of Thrones, I would get spoiled. But in regard to Line of Duty, because there's so many different ways a story could go in, it's absolutely impossible just from reading people's tweets and stuff to actually know what had gone on at all.
Oh,
it's all so
sort
of fanciful, and you do, it's hard to tell if you're not watching. Is that a joke? Is that person? Did that actually happen? So I didn't actually end up getting spoiled at all. So.
Well, one of the brilliant things about Line of Duty is it's all, unless, apart from after the final episode, it's almost impossible to give spoilers for Line of Duty because nobody has any idea what's going on.
Yeah.
Well, that's all we've got time for this week. Next week I'll be at Sapphire, SAP's event over in the US. So it just remains for me to say thank you very much to Brian.
Pleasure.
Thank you to Caroline.
You're welcome.
Next week Claire will be back and she'll be hosting.
Mm-hmm. In your absence.
Yeah, she will indeed. So thanks very much for listening. Bye.